Voices Radio.
Voices Radio.
Voices Radio.
Voices.
Voices Radio.
Radio.
Things Musicians Don't Talk About is supported by the Royal Society of Musicians. Since 1738, they have been providing vital financial assistance, advice, and guidance to music professionals unable to work due to accident, illness, stress, or anxiety. Whether you're working as a performer, administrator, technician, or teacher, and everything in between, they're there to help. If you know of someone in need, you can contact them in confidence by visiting their website, which is www.rsmgb.org, or you can contact them by ringing 020 7629 6137. Support their work by becoming a member or donating today.
Hello and welcome to Things Musicians Don't Talk About with your hosts, Hattie Butterworth.
And me, Rebecca Toll.
Within our vibrant musical world, it can often feel that the struggles and humanity of musicians is lost and restricted.
Having both suffered in silence with mental, physical and emotional issues, we are now looking for a way to voice musicians' stories, discuss them further and to connect with the many others who suffer like we have.
No topic will be out of bounds as we are committed to raising awareness for all varieties of struggle.
So join me, Hattie and guests as we attempt to bring an end to stigma by uncovering the things musicians don't talk about.
Welcome everyone to our Voices episode.
February, baby.
We're at the end of January. I can't believe we reached the end.
I know, it's been a long one.
It's been a very long one.
Dark and cold. So cold in the middle there.
Bloody hell, yeah. And now mild.
Very warm. And we've still got the heating on.
Me wool coat is made redundant.
I've stopped wearing hats.
I've stopped wearing them. I have got my little scarf out today though. So that's
did
nice.
You make that?
No, it does look like I did, but I got it from a charity shop. I think it is handmade. For audio description, it's sort of different shades of...
It looks like somebody's used up their leftover wool.
Yeah.
There's in a nice way.
There's sort of six stripes, six colours, one after the other.
Talking about stripes of colour, today we thought we'd talk about the gaze.
The gaze, the classical gaze.
The classical gaze. We're proud.
Yeah.
Well, not of all of them.
Not of all of them, no, absolutely. But I feel like classical music has a long history of queerness that maybe we don't really talk about much.
Underground
queer. Because I feel like with a lot of creative industries, it's where queer people navigate to, or yeah. Whether they mean to or not, it just happens to be a place where there's a lot more...
An outsider community.
Yeah, I guess so. And both within my own life and sort of in the media, it's very interesting to sort of watch and hear about these queer relationships, yes. Even just among kind of gossip in the classical sphere, which I get a lot in my office. It's like, did you know that they're together? And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't even know he was gay, but okay.
You're the gossip.
And then it's
queen.
Like, oh no, he's married to a woman, but everyone knows he's in a relationship. There seems to be a lot of that going on.
Yeah. Stockhausen had that, didn't he?
He did, Stockhausen.
Yeah, he had a wife and a partner.
Oh gosh, wow.
Both women.
Oh, okay.
But they both survived him and... Sorry, that sounded like survived.
No, I get it.
Yeah. They both outlasted him and would go to all his concerts.
Aww.
And all like concerts of his music after he died.
Wow.
Yeah, together.
Oh, cute.
Or not, like, together, but, like...
Well, maybe they were together.
Who knows? People probably did know, and we're probably... That is not the case.
But But there anyway. Have been, you know, in the last year, there's been two Hollywood films
mm-hmm.
about classical music.
Tar
and Maestro. Both of them have had the lead character in a queer either relationship or clearly, you know,
yeah.
identity in some way. Tar, Kate Blanchett, is a lesbian who mm-hmm. also is married but is preying on younger women.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Maestro, where about Leonard Bernstein, who was married quite young but then notoriously had numerous, mostly homosexual affairs mm-hmm. for the rest of his life.
He was married to a woman.
Married to a woman, yeah.
And had children with her.
Had children. So I just thought it'd be really interesting to kind of discuss like how these films portray queer identities, but also like how that sort of brings about power abuse.
Yes.
And how within classical music often either someone is very kind of clearly homosexual or there's a kind of grey area there of like...
Yeah. Nobody talks about it.
No one talks about it, exactly.
Because it's... Especially if it's a conductor or something, people are so in awe of their power and their virtuosity that it's like, ooh, we couldn't possibly...
tarnish this.
Yeah, exactly. By actually asking them what's going on. But it's this kind of mysterious air of this artistic genius can do whatever they want because they're a genius.
Mm-hmm. Literally. And that was really interesting at Classical Pride last year. There was this brilliant concert at the Barbican, which everyone should come to this year because it's happening again. And in the programme, they had a Q&A with Julian Anderson, who's an out composer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions was, which, you know, gay classical composers inspire you? And he listed all these people who were not out. And I was just like, what? Like, I didn't know that. Like,
wait, so he like outed them?
Or... I don't think he realised that they weren't
out. Oops.
But I guess there's just such a kind of culture of like...
Everyone knows,
but actually they have never said.
And because everyone in the music industry knows each other.
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously don't know Julian Anderson, but yeah, in you kind of have your circles, don't you? And then you have circles overlapping circles, and then everyone knows somebody who knows somebody.
But it's like either it's something that you might use for your art or like be very happy to sort of bring into your creative life, or it's something that's incredibly separate and no one knows about. So what are we going to say now?
Well, what I found interesting about Maestro was that there didn't seem to be, even though it was set before Tar, like Tar was set in today, like wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Whereas Maestro was in this...
It was sort of throughout.
60s? Yeah, kind of throughout.
From the 40s to the sort of 70s vibe, yeah. Was it?
Something around that. We did our research, we promise. There didn't seem to be much shame around his homosexuality. He didn't seem particularly secretive or ashamed of it. I mean, obviously it's a portrayal rather than an actual documentary, so I don't know whether that's actually how it was. But it was interesting that everybody knew, but it wasn't as though people weren't sharing it for fear of homophobia, it seemed. It was more like, I don't know.
Was it to protect him from the public, maybe?
I don't know.
The sort of saddest part of his queerness for me was when, obviously, he'd spent the whole film being, you know, having all these affairs and everything. And then his daughter... sort of was at Tanglewood and was hearing rumours about it and he confronted her and completely lied about it and said it's absolutely not true.
Yeah.
And that made me so sad because I was like, if I knew my dad had lied to me like that intensely about such a major part of his life.
And had like made the effort to come and have the conversation with me and then lied.
And in such a kind of trusting, like he seemed so trusting in it all. Do you know what I mean? And she looked so reassured by what he said.
I also didn't know whether him lying about that was more about his homosexuality or it being an affair, like extramarital.
Okay.
I wasn't clear. I mean, I don't think it was particularly clear in the film, but I think probably on purpose that there was all this kind of hazy.
It was very hazy.
Gray area of like, people aren't talking about this thing because I guess it's wrong, but nobody seems to have that much of a problem with it right now. I mean, Bernstein's wife seemingly did feel betrayed, but only
after the fact, sort of
thing. Yeah, by the secrecy of it rather than the actual act.
Yeah, because at the start of their marriage, she very much sort of said like she knew about it and she was sort of made out she would support him and was it looked like she was kind of comfortable with them having an open marriage.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like only later on did she realise how empty it felt.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to talk about, like, obviously there are people who have open marriages and are very happy within them.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, what was it about that specific situation that made her basically have a breakdown?
I mean, I guess it seemed to me like they actually had never had the actual conversations talking about the ins and outs of it and the kind of level of honesty they wanted or what that meant for her, like if she was going to see other people. It seemed kind of like he just took advantage of the fact that she was so caring and open-minded.
Would do anything for him.
Yeah, completely would do anything for him. Saw him as this
worshipped
brilliant
him.
Yeah, which I could see totally in the film, like he clearly was really brilliant and also seemingly a lovely person for the most of it. But there wasn't a lot of, I was going to say like negotiation, but like forward planning and kind of preempting situations and deciding what you're going to do in this event, or just, it felt like he was very careless with her emotions.
Yes.
And didn't really consider how that would affect her.
There was a kind of narcissism to do with his emotional or sexual life, wasn't there?
Yeah. It was almost like he felt entitled to it because he was so brilliant.
Yeah.
But it didn't come across in like an arrogant way like a lot of people do. It seemed kind of like, I don't know, kind of childish in a kind of innocent way and exciting and what he needed. But
yeah, it was like fulfilling a part of his life that she couldn't fulfill, and at the start she was very happy that he was able to do that with someone else.
Yeah,
but then it became clear the impact on his family and onto her and everything else.
Yeah, so in Maestro there's, I don't think we have really any scenes with Bernstein and students until the end, where you spent this whole film kind of seeing all different sides to Bernstein and the complexities of him, but I think you feel fairly favourable towards him.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene where he goes into a music college and immediate discomfort. I don't know how you felt, but he looked older, he looked kind of, it was after his wife had died, right? And he looked like he'd stopped really taking care of himself. And I don't know, there was just like so much sweat in the shot.
Yes, he was so fucking sweaty.
He was sweaty and the student was sweaty. It was really grim. And then he was touching the student really inappropriately from the lens of it being 2024 now. And then he went into a nightclub, right, with the student, and they were like dancing.
You reminded me now. Yeah.
And it was really uncomfortable and gross. And in Tar, what was the first? It was that she was the conductor of an orchestra.
So she, the first instance of, well, we kind of have glimpses from her assistant, who
was
a younger woman, that the assistant is very clear in love with her and sort of wants to be around her a lot, and it's so well acted by the woman who's also in Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Ooh,
that French actress, I can't remember her name, but she's amazing. And she kind of has this like wanting to be around her and like do everything for her.
Mm-hmm.
And Tar takes advantage of that because she knows she really likes her. And we kind of hear bits of how Tar has also had relations with this other girl.
Oh, yeah, that was
the ginger girl whose name I can't remember.
But there was...
Krista.
Yeah, there was like a mystery throughout the film about what had happened.
What had actually happened with this other younger woman, other young conductor.
But people would always say it in a way of like hushed.
Yes.
And kind of, clearly something really bad had happened.
Yeah. And actually, it's one of the things when you rewatch the film, which I know not many people have done because they didn't like it, but
yeah.
I've rewatched it twice. And when you can pause on things like the emails and texts and you read them, it's really interesting to see the sort of total panic that this girl, Krista, had, that Tar had stopped talking to her. And basically, Tar had like basically blacked her name to all these orchestras around the world and sort of said, don't take her, she's a nasty piece of work.
Yeah.
Because she knew she'd gone too far with her.
Yeah.
But anyway, fast forward to like the present day, and this young cellist who is only about 20 joins the orchestra, or is auditioning to join the orchestra. No, she has joined the orchestra, but Tar sees her in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Hears her, sees her shoes, which are like kind of heels. And then when she comes to do the blind audition, she sees the heels and she sort of scribbles out what she had written and changes it more favourably, basically.
Yeah.
Long story short, then we basically see her trying to get involved with this young cellist who actually isn't really that bothered, which is really interesting. She's not taken by Tar. She's kind of like...
She appreciates the attention, but almost... uses it to get to where she wants to be, which I thought was quite like, I was like, yes.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, fine, I'll come to New York with you, but I'm not going to have sex. Like, I'm not going to hang out with you. I'm just going to go to bed.
Or like, and then she goes to see her other friends, right?
Yeah, and gets with a guy.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's so interesting how there are some personalities, and I don't know whether this is like trauma based or to do with attachment styles or what it is, but there are some personalities where a personality like Tar or Bernstein will, whether they know it or not, they will kind of feel attracted to them.
Yeah.
Sap out the kind of, this is where it makes me so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, see the weakness, grab onto it, give so much kind of mentorship,
love,
and then sort of have the power to just take it away or like destroy someone's life or career.
And what was in both the films, what seemed interesting about both of them being homosexual relationships was that because people were keeping it like hushed, like not really talking about it for fear of whatever, that enabled the power abuse.
That's so true.
Because it became like, oh, well, we can't talk about that thing because that he's gay, which meant that nobody picked him up on the fact that he was basically preying on... Well, I guess there was the young conductor first,
right? Yes, yeah.
And then, was he a composer?
Yeah, he was an assistant of some sort.
Some kind of assistant. And then later on, the student at the music college, it was like... Well, by that point, he was a mess, but also like a legend, so I guess nobody would have had the guts to say anything. But
do you think they were both protected by a marriage? Did they think they were protected by
probably
a marriage? Obviously Tars was a same-sex marriage,
yeah,
but is that a way of kind of for them being in denial that
I think there's an element of people don't want to draw attention to it in case it breaks down their marriage or something.
And when there's someone else involved, it's sort of, is that
I want to protect their feelings, and it's like don't use them as a reason to not,
because I feel like when you're trying to bring justice to something like this, often what people say is, I don't want to ruin their career, I don't want to ruin their family, you know. And you're kind of like, it's funny. When they have those two things, it's almost like they're less likely to be held to account, but they should be more likely to be held to account.
Absolutely, because they've got these things.
Yeah. It really interests me that how people are like, oh, I don't want to sort of ruin my teacher's career by speaking out about them.
Yeah.
And it's like, they shouldn't have that career. They're not deserving of that career.
yeah, there's so much hierarchy and there's so much respect for art above humans. Unlike a lot of industries.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like the ethereal quality to being a genius is untouchable. And it's wrong.
But you're so right, though, because if these were heterosexual relationships, people would talk about them in a much different way.
Yeah, I think nowadays...
it would always be more disgusting.
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
Well, we'll see.
I mean...
but it like, will keep happening.
Yeah, it's just... it's almost like if it's an older man with a younger student, that's absolutely horrific. But if it's an older woman with a younger student, you just wouldn't hear about it. I don't know.
I wonder whether there's an element of people not wanting to talk about homosexual relationships because there is an element of homophobia.
Yeah.
Or of saying the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And also, I think people have a subconscious feeling that if people enter into a homosexual relationship, no matter if there is power imbalance, that they have done that willingly and they've chosen to enter into that.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think comes back to the misbelief that homosexuality is a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's all kind of tied up in decades of homophobia. Well, millions of years of homophobia, I think.
Yeah.
But it's kind of presented as a, actually the opposite, that, you know, well, they can do what they want. I don't have a problem with it. And it's like, no, actually, you don't want to talk about it because you're disgusted, or you see it as a, it's their fault if they get hurt or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Man. So much to say.
So much to say.
Did you have anything else? Or
well, I was just going to say that we, for the rest of our episode, are going to, like, because we wanted to keep the episode on the topic of queerness.
Mm-hmm.
We have an interview that Hattie did a long time ago with the legend that is Ella Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what it entails?
Sure. So this interview happened quite shortly after Ella, who is a non-binary soprano, just after they had, I think, been runner-up in the renowned Kathleen Ferrier competition.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard about them kind of online here and there. And even back then, I think I still wasn't totally, I didn't have a full understanding of what someone, like a non-binary person, what they were, or like how they felt, or especially as a musician, how they could navigate that in things like funding and biographies and,
mm-hmm.
You know, all this kind of thing. And it still happens in my work. If there's a non-binary person we're writing about, people will be like, why have you said they? And I'm like, because they're non-binary. But it doesn't make grammatical sense. And I'm like, it's going to have to. Does. Can we just chill? Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, it was a while ago. It was 2021, mm-hmm. I think. But we chatted about... I think Ella at that point was doing a young artist program called the National Opera Studio,
mm-hmm.
or they'd just finished that. And that's a very kind of high profile British association with a lot of older donors and stuff. So we talk about kind of how they navigated that and how they came into their own kind of with their gender expression and identity. And yeah, I think people have told me they've enjoyed that episode. It feels quite old now, but
still,
I think it'll still have, I think it'll still have like an important, I mean, Ella is just doing, by the way, since then, Ella has gone on to like
stratospheric levels,
absolute stratospheric levels. They've performed twice in major roles at Royal Opera House.
Yeah.
They're going to do a show at, the Dutch National Opera this month. Like nice. They're amazing. So
keep listening.
Keep listening.
It will be part of the episode and then you can go and listen to the rest mm-hmm. on our usual places if you fancy it. So Hattie, win of the week to end the episode.
So I would say win of the week. I've been more I've like planned out my food better.
This is a big thing, like, yeah.
You know, I think you get what I mean.
Like, I get it.
It can be really hard to think about what do I want to eat for dinner and what am I going to buy for that and how it's am I really going to think about this. So I've really, in my new house, which I've just moved to, I've tried to start again a little bit with all that and not just sort of say, oh, I'll eat anything, yeah, but actually to think, like, what do I want? What am I going to have for lunch?
Nice.
And it is a sort of money-saving thing because I do know I spend far too much money on extra food. And
is it far too much money or are things just too expensive?
Well, exactly. It's both, isn't it?
It's both.
But yeah, so that's been kind of nice to buy things for the future. Does that make sense? I feel I buy everything for right now in the past. But like thinking about, oh, future me might really appreciate having a stock of like granola bars in the cupboard or like, you know, having a crumble in 3 nights' time.
Mm-hmm. So, wait, you mean the food a crumble, not an emotional crumble?
Oh, I'll definitely have both at the same time. Both crumbles happen at the same time. What about you, my darling?
My win of the week is kind of similar to yours in that I feel like I'm planning a bit better into the, like, for future me. I think I've become so averse to this by being like, I'm just going to live in the moment, be mm-hmm. mindful, you know, not hold myself to things if it doesn't suit where I'm at. But I don't know, like after my counselling course every Wednesday now, I go to a yoga class and I book it a week in advance. And I've been like 4 weeks in a row now. And I know it's something small, but it's that thing of I know this is going to be good for me. And even if I get back and I don't want to go back out again, I do it anyway. And I have very few things in my life where I feel like that's an okay thing, like an okay mentality that I'll go and do this thing anyway.
I know what you mean.
But
I think when you've been restrictive in some way, it's quite hard.
Yes.
You still go all the way the other way, but then you're like, oh, I feel like there should be an element of either structure or like accountability.
Yeah.
But how to get that back without sacrificing the freedom.
Yeah, and Stu and I have been like planning our meals and shopping and like planning a date night each week and this kind of thing.
Oh, nice. So
a bit more planning in my life, which has felt quite nice.
It's very January of us, isn't it, really?
Amidst the chaos.
Yeah.
It doesn't all go to plan, but that's fine. Instead of putting half of Ella's episode here, we decided to just leave it and you should go and listen to the full thing on our podcast main feed, wherever you usually get that. So that's all from us for now. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks or maybe a week, who knows, for our next episode, which will be with the incredible conductor Chloe van Surtested. Keep your ears out on Storks, keep your eyes out, you're not going to want to miss that one. We talk about motherhood, working, and, you know, in the classical music industry with traveling and having a baby and the idea of being a mother in classical music and people's preconceptions about what that means. And yeah, it was incredible chat. So for now, goodbye and see you soon.